I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up in a few moments, a military analyst who wrote the book on how not to fight the war in Iraq. Why didn't anyone listen? But first, to the Middle East, where the two Palestinian territories are under control of warring factions. Today, the European Union pledged to restore hundreds of millions of dollars of aid to the Palestinian Authority after President Mahmoud Abbas installed an emergency government in the West Bank yesterday. Western countries first cut off aid to the Palestinian territories last year when the militant party Hamas won elections over Abbas's own Fatah party. Last week, tensions between the two groups erupted in an open warfare. Now the territories are split in two, with Abbas's Fatah party controlling the West Bank after Hamas seized the smaller Gaza. For the latest on the situation, we go to Eileen Prater, a Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. And Eileen, first to this promise of aid from the European Union, how is it going to be directed? If it's funneled to Abbas, does he have concerns if he sends it to Gaza, it will fall in the hands of Hamas?
Well, what we're seeing right now is the possibility that such aid will not be actually sent to Gaza at all. In fact, that aid, from what we understand so far, is really going to be focused on improving conditions in the West Bank, allowing the Palestinian Authority to pay salaries that it's had a difficulty paying in the year and a half or so since the Hamas-led government was elected. And in fact, in Gaza, what we're more likely to see is just purely humanitarian aid funneled through the UN, which will be in the form of foodstuffs, medicines, and not to see any of that aid actually go to Gaza. And, you know, it's a very important point that you bring up, because what this seems like it will lead to is not just a great political gap, of course, but a kind of yawning economic gap between the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
You know, we know now that Israel and Egypt have cut off their borders to the Gaza Strip, where 1.5 million people lived in this fenced-in coastal area. Hundreds have been trying to flee Hamas, are trapped along the border. There are, as you said, so many concerns. Can Abbas afford to be seen as cutting off fellow Palestinians?
That's a great question. I think it'll be a sense of, well, who's really cutting people off? You know, Hamas is now in control of the borders with Israel and with Egypt. I understand that there are some discussions underway to at least keep some basic things flowing. For example, Gaza is dependent on Israel to get its fuel, and the main Israeli company that was providing that shut off the taps in the middle of the civil war last week, but has now resumed it. So there is a chance that, you know, some basic foodstuffs and, you know, everyday items will still be able to get in. But you do pose a very important question, which is if the condition for Palestinians in Gaza of everyday life continues to deteriorate more and more, does it really turn people against Hamas, or does it perhaps even further radicalize people, make them blame Mahmoud Abbas and make him be seen in the eyes of some Palestinians as some kind of puppet or lackey of the West?
Meanwhile, there was talk over the weekend that the goal was to have perhaps two Palestinian states, one the smaller Gaza, a more closed society under Hamas, the other a more open society under Fatah and Abbas. But we're reading that Hamas says they still recognize Mahmoud Abbas as president. They don't want to run a mini state in Gaza. So is there still a hope for a diplomatic joining again of these two forces?
I think anything is possible, and it certainly seems to be that what Hamas is saying. They've been expressing that they don't intend to be some kind of Islamic mini-state that is independent, but in fact they haven't accepted the decision of Abbas to dissolve the last government. Ismail Haniyeh, the leader of Hamas, has said that he's still prime minister, and in the West Bank you have Fatah saying, no, he's no longer prime minister. So it doesn't seem like it's going to happen in the immediate future, at least, that you could see the parties come together. Anything is possible through negotiations, but it seems now that there's an attempt to, you know, at the very least, to kind of hold back on revenge attacks between Fatah and Hamas, and a sense of the people in Fatah and the West Bank of wanting to move forward with renewing relations with the international community, improve life there, and take a sort of wait-and-see approach with what Hamas is going to do in Gaza.
Meanwhile, President Bush is set to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert tomorrow to discuss the possible return of funds that are held by the Israeli government. Eileen Prater is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you so much, Eileen.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the U.S. coalition leader in Baghdad said this past weekend that it could take a decade to stabilize Iraq. That's something Dr. Conrad Crane also advised in the run-up to the war. Dr. Crane is a 26-year Army veteran and director of the U.S. Army Military History Institute at the Army War College. In the months leading up to the 2003 invasion, military leaders urgently wanted to know what challenges they might face in Iraq. So they asked Dr. Crane and a colleague to find out, and they produced an 84-page booklet entitled Reconstructing Iraq: Insights, Challenges, and Missions for the Military Forces in a Post-Conflict Scenario. And it's startlingly prescient. They warned that Iraqi exiles were unpopular in Iraq, that religious factors in the country would make suicide bombing a concern, and the list goes on, a chilling description of what has actually occurred. So what happened? Did anyone listen? Dr. Conrad Crane joins us now from the studios of WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, with his story. Welcome, Dr. Crane.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, let's go to now. You're known now in military circles as a Cassandra, you know, someone who saw this coming. Are you comfortable with that?
Especially since Cassandra did not end very well.
She was doomed to tell the truth but never to be believed.
Yes. It has given me avenues into a lot of different places where I can contribute. So even though the initial effort didn't reap the fruits that we had hoped, it has paid off in other ways.
How so? You mean in changes now or thinking now? Or
people paid attention afterwards, and it has changed the way that the people have looked at stability operations. The military is trying to do them a lot better. And it partly is because of the reputation I built from this. I was picked to be the lead author for the new counterinsurgency manual for the Army and Marine Corps that just came out last December.
Well, now, was this the manual that General Petraeus worked on as well?
Yes. General Petraeus is my old West Point classmate. He tapped me for that, and we worked together on it.
And it sounds like something else you both had in common was that your thinking about how to approach the war was sidelined early on. General Petraeus talked about working with and understanding the population he was not listened to then, but his theories are in play now, aren't they?
Yes, they are. His approach, which is very population-centric versus an enemy-centric approach, which was initially applied, has really kind of become the doctrine and the accepted way to deal with these things.
That's in line with what you were writing in 2003. Let's talk about your initial pre-war report on Iraq. It's frustrating to read it, you know, remembering how the architects of the war were saying it would be a cakewalk, that Iraqis would greet U.S. soldiers with flowers. Take us back. How did your report come about? Who commissioned it? What was the mood at the time?
In the summer of 2002, the Central Command was told that there was going to be a change in plans for the post-war. Up until about June of 2002, they expected that any kind of post-war situation in Iraq was going to be controlled by the State Department. In June of 2002, they were told, by the National Command Authority, they were told there would be some kind of a military government in Iraq. And so the Army especially started looking at this as an issue, the potential problems and the missions for the mayor of Baghdad, as they foresaw it. And the War College took that up. And we got together a team from the National Defense University, the Joint Staff, the Army Staff, State Department, the Army War College, think tanks, major intelligence agencies. And in December of 2002, we got everybody together at the War College. We were unlucky, and the weather was very bad. We had a big ice storm when we had the conference. But we were lucky, though, because it basically shut down post except for us. We were all locked in a building. Nobody was going to go anywhere.
And as you set out on this, I mean, in reading it, it seems like one big red flag. Caution, alert, warning. Was that the mood as you put this together?
We were very pessimistic. From the historical overview, it was obvious that these kind of operations always took a lot of time, a lot of resources, a lot of manpower, and that was something we wanted to put up front. The Iraqi regional experts were also very cognizant of the violent atmosphere in Iraq and the potential for violence and the very rough political history of the country. We just saw this as a very complex operation, even in a more stable state. And in this case, we're doing it in a very unstable region. And so that's where a lot of the cautions came from.
You warned architects of the war away from Ahmed Chalami, the exiled Iraqi leader. You quoted CIA analysts who said he was unliked in the country. You warned them about the Shia-Sunni factionalism. You warned them about the picture that we're looking at now.
There were two things working against us. One was that the CIA had a much rosier picture that leaders were reading. The other thing that hurt us was that just when we finished the study in January of 2003 and gave it to the Army, the National Command Authorities decided that at that point that the post-war Iraq would be handled by Lieutenant General Jay Garner's Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Affairs, which was one of the great tragedies, really, of the whole process, because it really stood up too late and with too little to really be effective for what it was intended to do. Plus, it kind of killed the momentum of what we were doing. And our study, which was no longer as important for the Army as it was before. And it wasn't really until after things started to unravel in the summer of 2003 that interest picked up in it again.
What was that like? You for instance, read in the newspaper when the Coalition Provisional Authority disbanded the Iraqi army, something that you had warned about in your report. You read about that in the newspaper. What was it like for you to have this, you know, suddenly all of this urgency about writing this manual just completely drop and watch it unfold from there?
That was kind of a shock. The Army decision. I'd actually been communicating with some officers in Baghdad who were working on how to better integrate the Iraqi Army into their operations, and they were surprised as well. The Army was one of the few institutions in the country with a true national reputation that could really tie it together.
Talk a little bit more about history. You are a historian, and you refer back quite a bit in the report. For instance, you write that after World War I, the U.S. learned its lesson in failing to reconstruct Germany effectively. So they set about doing that differently in World War II. Just how so? I mean, just a couple of the things that you thought might have been learned after World War II.
At the end of World War I, the Army has the United States has a small area of occupation in Germany, and there was a very, very good study done by a Colonel Hunt, who is the civil affairs officer in charge of much of the operation, and said, look, we weren't ready for this, and we've got to do better the next time. And his study, which is written in 1920, circulates through the Army, makes an impact, and when we're getting into World War II, that study gets resurrected, and people look at it and say, look, we need to do better the next time. And they actually set up a school of military government in Charlottesville, Virginia, and set up military government teams. And when we get into Japan and Germany and Italy and places like that, we've already got the structure in place to put on the ground, and we understand this is going to take a while to do, and we've studied those different regions, and we understand some of the cultural characteristics, and we're really ready for it. And if we look at our history, which is always an iffy tool to use, because no two situations are exactly alike. You know, there's a saying, there are no lessons from history, only insights. But there are a lot of insights to be gained from our past experience, and we argued in the study that they should be looked at and applied, not just for major wars, but also for the experiences we had in the 1990s in these smaller-scale contingencies in places like Haiti, Somalia, the Balkans. And I understand there were some arguments at the time that a large footprint in Iraq would immediately spark an insurgency, and in fact, I think that kind of the opposite happened. It was a small footprint in Iraq that actually helped the insurgency to rise.
That's Dr. Conrad Crane of the U.S. Army War College. After a quick break, how he tried to get his concerns about Iraq out through back channels. And this quick note still to come today, that Renegade AA meeting in Washington, D.C. Back after the break, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from Dr. Conrad Crane, the military historian who directs the Army Archives at the U.S. Army War College in Pennsylvania, and wrote a report before the Iraq War started that foresaw the sectarian violence, the suicide bombings, everything so common now in country, but his advice was largely ignored. Dr. Crane, I'm thinking of the voices that we heard saying the same thing you were saying before the invasion. Anthony Cordesman, who told us, I can't see how this is going to happen unless there's a second army after the combat army that's trained for occupation. I'm also thinking of military analyst Andrew Basevich, who raised fierce alarms before the invasion, and as you well know, I'm sure, his son was recently killed in Iraq.
We're both alumni of the West Point History Department. I've known him. He's one of the more evocative and eloquent critics of the war, and he's a great patriot as well. The arguments he makes because he thinks that's the, you know, what the United States needs to hear, and it really is a tragedy with his son. I know that everybody who knows him, the West Point community, the historical community, everyone was just basically devastated by that news.
Especially since you had made warnings.
Can
I just ask you?
I tell you, we've all lost people like that, though. I've lost a number of the cadets I taught at West Point that have died.
This must be unbearable.
Well, I would say this, that because I taught at West Point through 2000, and I watched the casualty list from Iraq, and they say that parents should not bury their children. Well, teachers should not have to bury their students either, and it's just but these young men and women at West Point who sign up to go there know what they're getting into, and it's one of the sad realities of war that good people die.
What is it, sir? I mean, maybe you're not at liberty to say, but I mean, we're trying to get at the disconnect between people like yourself and others who are schooled in this, write this book that pretty much lays out everything that's going to go wrong, and it does go wrong. Where's the disconnect? Is it simple arrogance? Is it
Again, there are other authors that have written about this. The argument has been made that decision makers had a certain predilection, a certain direction they wanted to go, and they were more likely to look at reports that supported that particular point of view.
But they cherry-picked it. They cherry-picked the information they wanted to carry out the war that they wanted to carry out.
And there were, and that argument's been made by many people, but there were a lot of studies that supported that point of view. There was enough of a variance of opinion that they could justify the choices that they made. Again, I don't know exactly everything they looked at. I have no evidence, for instance, that our study ever got outside the Army. So I can't say that we were making this argument to Secretary Rumsfeld or the President.
What were you trying to do behind the scenes? I mean, were you trying to get this information to someone?
Throughout this whole process, we were sending our work to planners in Central Command through back channels. We did lead them to ask for more forces, but they couldn't get their requests through channels. So we didn't have a lot of we didn't have the impact we had hoped before, though we did influence planners to some extent. Now, afterwards, our study was transmitted much more through Central Command through Colonel H.R. McMaster on General Abizaid's special staff, and he said he was handing it out like it was Hare Krishna literature.
Well, you make the case in your report that the danger isn't in winning the war, but in losing the peace. Has the U.S. lost the peace?
I don't think it's lost yet. General Petraeus is over there trying to apply the new doctrine. He's involved in the so-called surge. The issue over there as I see it, is going to be whether, I think that his acumen, his finesse, his talents, the forces he has over there can create a window of security opportunity, but it's got to be seized by the Iraqi government. And my biggest concern right now is whether the Iraqi government can take advantage of whatever opportunities are created. And that, I'm not giving up yet. I think there's still a possibility that can happen. And there, you can even argue that either different degrees of success or different degrees of failure. It's going to be a very, very tumultuous future coming up for Iraq. These type of operations always take a lot of time, a lot of resources, a lot of people. You can't do these on the cheap. This is still a part of our, I think the military is doing much better in these operations now and is kind of grasping a lot better. We still have a lot of work to do in creating the interagency capability, capacity, and culture to do these operations better as well.
Yeah. Well, but Iraq is still not at the electricity capacity, for instance, that it was pre the invasion. How underprepared do you think the Army was, despite your warnings and warnings of others? How underprepared do you think it went into this war?
Well, it was well prepared for the combat phase, and it was somewhat prepared for the post-war phase. And there actually was a lot of planning that went into the reconstruction phase, but it was disjointed. There was a lot of uncertainty about who was going to be doing what. There were a lot of assumptions made about who it was going to be handed off to. There were a lot of bad assumptions. It was unfocused. It was uncoordinated. We also didn't have the right doctrine for the insurgency that bubbled up. One of the ironies is that in 2002, I did a study for the Strategic Studies Institute talking about how the Army and had kind of thrown away its counterinsurgency doctrine and didn't have the right doctrine for it. And that's another mission that I've picked up since. I'm almost afraid to write anything else. I write a study that says we need to do better stability operations. I get to do the study on reconstructing Iraq. I do a study that says we've got faulty or we lack counterinsurgency doctrine, and now I get the mission to rewrite our counterinsurgency doctrine. Well, I'm not sure what I should write next.
I know. Well, and we should read it. But what? For instance, how can you have the wrong counterinsurgency? I mean, what was the? Just give us the line about what the thinking was that was wrong.
After Vietnam, the Army especially, and the military in general, basically throws away its counterinsurgency doctrine. The philosophy is we're just not going to fight those kind of wars anymore. Instead of fighting better, we're just not going to fight them. That we really didn't have a counterinsurgency doctrine to deal with a major conventional force involvement for a big insurgency. It was kind of only for little ones. It really took a couple years to kind of master it again and to get back into doing it. And in those first couple years is when the insurgency really blossomed and expanded. If we'd had the better doctrine coming in, we could have kept it at a low level and would have made our problems at this stage a lot easier to deal with.
Dr. Conrad Crane, director of the U.S. Army Military History Institute at the U.S. Army War College in Pennsylvania. As we said, he was commissioned to write a report prior to the invasion of Iraq detailing the problems that might arise in Reconstruction. He raised a lot of red flags, but the Pentagon took a different tack going into the invasion. Dr. Crane, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Okay, still ahead today. Did an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting break the rules and a decades-old trust? Back after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. An estimated 2 million recovering alcoholics gather in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings worldwide. Millions more swear by the group's ability through anonymous group sharing to help them find sobriety. But a report in Newsweek of allegations against one group in Washington, D.C. has the 12-step community on edge and in the news. D.C.'s Midtown Alcoholics Anonymous group is being called a cult, with charges that it tells new members to cut off ties with friends and family, give up their prescription medications, and allegedly the group pushes younger members to have sexual relations with older ones, all of which is strictly against AA's written principles. Reporter Nick Summers reported the piece for Newsweek. He joins us from the NPR studios in D.C. And Nick, you spoke to a young woman who first came into the Midtown group in Washington at 15. Now, that raised our first question. We understand there are AA groups just for young people that would separate them.
Well, that's one of the things about AA is it's a large organization with sort of no organizing principles. And so there are groups for young people, groups for old people, groups for veterans. A group works if it works.
According to the AA traditions, each group is autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Well, that young woman that you spoke to, Mae Clancy, what did she tell you about the Midtown group?
Well, this young woman had been through a lot of rehab programs, and her parents were very worried about her. And when she found this group, Midtown, they were overjoyed. It worked. There were lots of young people there. They couldn't be happier and more relieved that their daughter was getting better. She was not drinking anymore, but she was forming dependencies with this group that were just as harmful, her parents came to believe.
Such as?
AA normally teaches people to repair relationships with people they may have harmed through their drinking.
This is called making amends.
Exactly. And while this group does encourage that, it also encourages its members to cut off ties to those people and to only be friends with people in this group, to date within this group. And first, it seems great. You get a job through people in this group. Your roommates are people in this group. And initially, this can be a really good thing. But over time, these connections become restraints. And if you become dissatisfied with the group or want to leave for any reason, it's no longer a matter of just walking out the door. It means losing your job. It means getting evicted from your apartment. It means breaking up with your boyfriend or girlfriend.
And by the way, specifically against AA principles, AA discourages beginning any new relationships early on in sobriety, much
right.
less within the group. But, you know, was she, as you say, encouraged to date or to sleep with people in AA?
May described a culture in which young people in the group were encouraged to date. This is one of the areas that's a real lightning rod of criticism within D.C. area AA. They really think this is inappropriate. People enter AA, especially young people, at the worst moment of their lives, really, at their most vulnerable point. And to get into a relationship with a sponsor is considered one of the absolute no-nos in AA, especially in an older sponsor who is taking responsibility for your getting better.
Well, since your report, a local television news team, News 4 in Washington, reports that a police officer's wife came forward and said that she was encouraged to cheat on her husband with members of the group. And News 4 also reports that other people were heard speaking about all the men that they had slept with within the group.
Yeah, that's something that I heard a lot of, is very, very frank, open, discussing dating within the group. And, you know, at the beginning, this can seem like a good thing. I mean, people who are, especially young people who are told that they need to give up alcohol for the rest of their lives, can be very frightened. How am I ever going to have fun again? How am I going to date again without alcohol? And so to find a relationship in this group can seem like a blessing, but it quickly becomes exploitative when very young women begin having sexual relationships with multiple older men, and being told that this is important to their sobriety, to their recovery, told that this will, is a spiritual thing that will help them survive. It quickly crosses the line and has gotten a lot of not just ex-members, but doctors, rehab workers really opposed to this group.
We understand leaders in the group also, instead of, as the AA traditions say, are just trusted servants but don't govern and usually change all the time. It's a shared responsibility, that it was more hardened and hierarchical in this Midtown group.
Yeah, and that's a major difference between Midtown and standard AA, is that it does have people who are widely regarded as leaders. In most AA, it's a founding principle that no matter how much sobriety you have, you're the same number of drinks away from falling off the wagon as a newcomer. You're one drink away, and the founder Bill W. would point out, I'm not a messiah. I'm a drunk. I am a person who is taking this one day at a time, just like the most recent person to walk in the door.
So a host of complaints, but do you also hear from people, I mean, alcoholism, a terrible disease, do you also hear from people saying, look, you know, I know someone who became sober in that group?
Yeah, the problem is this group helps people get sober, and that's a really hard idea to get your head around. And a lot of this group's critics will say that, yes, this group does help people get sober. The question is, at what price? The critics of this group point out there are lots and lots and lots of other groups for young people in the Washington area where dating within the group is not done, and where young women are much more protected.
Well, this must be a very difficult issue to even report. We contacted the New York Central Service offices of Alcoholics Anonymous for a comment, and they declined, as we expected, because AA remains anonymous at the level of press, television, and radio. That's their saying, and they have no opinion on issues guiding individual groups, which are autonomous. Again, this is a very private but public group. Is there any sense that any law officials might get involved because of some of the allegations?
Police in Maryland and the district have investigated the group for more than a year, but they are not making charges. I mean, they talked to me about the difficulty of making charges against people in this group, because it's difficult for victims to come forward. And even when they do, there's the issue of how you prove something happened months, if not years ago. And it's just very difficult to move forward.
But we do understand that some of the churches where the meetings were held have said that they no longer feel comfortable having the meetings there.
That's right. After Newsweek's story ran, the group was asked to leave a couple of the churches where it meets, and there was a rehab in Maryland that shut its doors to this group. AA counts on groups to be fluid and for people to vote with their feet when they become dissatisfied with the meeting and just move on down the road to the next one. What makes Midtown different is that it keeps members in the group in a number of ways. And for many people whose sobriety, whose lives are built on membership in this group, it can be very difficult for them to leave, even if they believe that this group has gone off the reservation.
That's Newsweek reporter Nick Summers, who reported on accusations that the Midtown Alcoholics Anonymous group in Washington, D.C. has become something of a cult. Nick, thanks so much for spending some time to tell us about it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as always, we want to hear from you. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. And by the way, if you're at the website, here-now.org, you can hear any program by going to the archives, or you can download podcasts of the program to take with you. Still to come today, you know that show Hell's Kitchen, where all the competing chefs cry? Well, Chef Marco Pierre White is the guy who made the Hell's Kitchen host cry. You'll meet him. You're listening to Here and Now. School is out, or just about out, for summer, but for a growing number of kids, How will they know? They don't go to school because their parents and some educators say a formal education can damper a child's innate love of learning as the child tries to drive in knowledge and facts. It's called unschooling, and Sandy Totten reports.
It's one thing to homeschool your child. Parents become teachers and can download lesson plans, buy workbooks, or register kids for online classes. It's another thing to unschool your child. Kelly Trossett insists she's not the teacher for her three children.
One time I phrased it as a tour guide, but I thought that was kind of corny, but yet kind of true, because I kind of helped them along. And you know.
During the hours most kids are at school, Kelly's house is full of activity.
That's not it. There.
Her kids spend the day playing music, surfing the internet, reading, painting, or whatever else catches their fancy. You see, unschooling is about letting the child decide what to do and what to learn. For Kelly's 11-year-old daughter, Abby, that means studying piano, updating her blog, or reciting Shakespeare.
Double, double, boil in trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble.
That's from Macbeth. Abby read that when she was 9. She studied other classics, too.
What's the one with the ghost and Hamlet? Yes, everyone ends up dead. Gotta love it.
Abby says on any given day, she has dozens of interests. Abby's older brother, Alec, is much more focused. He delves into his studies for days at a time, sometimes staying up late in the night working out a single problem. He's only 14, but he has the determination of a graduate student. Except, he's not solving complicated math equations.
He won't give me an open.
He's playing video games.
This game is so, there's so much in it. Now I've put a total of at least 300 hours into it.
Spending months on Shakespeare is one thing, but playing World of Warcraft, Final Fantasy, and Halo 2? But that's part of unschooling. Kelly says if you tell your kids what they can and can't learn from, you'll shut down their curiosity. That's what she saw happening to Alec when he was in school. She says he was bored, depressed, that he was losing his drive to learn. So she pulled him out of the third grade. Since then, he's spent his time building massive Lego ships, studying Japanese samurai, and playing his Xbox. But Kelly says video games inspire Alec to learn about other things, too.
If you want to use school terms, geography, history, social studies.
Unschooling isn't a new idea. Thinkers from Socrates to Jean-Jacques Rousseau have touted the benefits of letting a child's interests lead their education. But it was John Holt who penned the term unschooling in the late 1970s. Recently, the idea has been catching on. Unschooling message boards and listservs are springing up all over the country, some with several hundred members. But critics are on the rise, too. They say it's wonderful to think kids will soak up knowledge on their own.
Our experience is that isn't what happens.
That's Gretchen Wheelwright, a retired high school teacher, principal, and professor at Troy University in Alabama. She remembers public schools trying a similar approach in the 60s and 70s. Students could choose their own classes and work on self-directed projects.
5 years, 10 years later, they didn't know anything. They had these vast gaps in their knowledge in areas they should have known.
Gretchen says even someone who loves to read Shakespeare needs to know math, science, and history. In states like Minnesota, children taught at home are required to take annual exams, but the State Department of Education never looks at the results. That makes it tricky for college admissions counselors. Yet some universities, like Stanford and MIT, have welcomed some of these unconventional students. Roya Sarushian says, for her, getting into college wasn't a problem. She's been unschooled since the fourth grade. She passed the high school equivalency exam at 15. Now, at 22, she just graduated from California State University at Long Beach. Roya says when she first started taking formal classes, she was amazed at the differences between her and her classmates.
I'd get homework and I'd go do it, and yet all the other students wouldn't do it at all, or they'd try to do the least they could. And I think that's because they're tired of school. They're tired of people telling them what's important for them to learn right now. I never had that.
Roya says her education gave her plenty of freedom, and that freedom is at the heart of unschooling. But still, many parents and educators wonder, left to their own devices, will kids find their own internal compass and succeed in life? Or will many lose their way without the roadmap of a structured education?
Sandy Totten in Minneapolis. For more on unschooling, go to our website, here-now.org. The original Devil in the Kitchen is next, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Before superstar chefs like Mario Batali of the Food Network or Gordon Ramsay of Fox's Hell's Kitchen, there was the man who trained and terrorized both of them, Chef Marco Pierre White. The man with the French-Italian name, who was actually born in public housing in Leeds, was the youngest chef and the first in his native Britain to receive 3 stars, the highest rating, from the famed Michelin Guide. But in pursuit of that goal, he rode himself and his staffs mercilessly. When a cook complained it was too hot, Marco took a knife and sliced his clothing off. When another made soup that was too cold, Marco poured it down his apron, followed by the croutons. He would regularly throw chefs who disappointed him into the garbage can or tell patrons to, well, to leave. He also created dishes so beautiful, so detailed, they made grown food critics cry. He'd roast 36 chickens just for their juice. And service. What other restaurant set out a side table just for a woman's handbag? Well, then Chef Pierre White hung up his apron and quit the stove, just like that. He's written a memoir. It's called The Devil in the Kitchen, and Marco Pierre White joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
Should I be afraid of you?
I'm thinking I should be afraid of you.
You know, that was, you know, you hung up your apron in what, 99?
23rd of December, 1999.
Not that you're remembering closely, but do you think that you have, quieted down since then? I mean, how would you?
Well, I've never lost my temper since I left the kitchen.
Yeah. Let's give people an idea of what that temper was and then why. For instance, I know everyone drags this out, but the cheese trolley. This is when you had your famed restaurant at the Hyde Park Hotel.
Hyde Park Hotel.
And you had a simple rule that the cheese had to be just right, a certain size.
You know, if you ask for cheese, you ought to see a generous cheese board or cheese trolley, whichever you've got in your restaurants. And when I'm brought a trolley, I don't want to see little bits of cheese on a trolley left over from lunch service. I expect to see generous portions of cheese, all perfectly ripe, all ready to be served.
And when you didn't one day, poor Nico the maitre d' made the mistake of apparently serving 2 small cheese, and you picked them up one by one.
And, you know, maybe I went a little bit mad.
Do you think so?
I took every cheese, and I threw every cheese against the wall.
Not only did you heave the cheeses at the wall, but you insisted that they stay there, except for the camembert, which snailed down to the floor.
Well, they all started to walk down the wall. Well, they came to clear them off, and I refused to let any of the staff clear them for the simple reasons I wanted every person in that establishment to see what I'd done. They never forget. If they try to get something past me, it's not going to happen. You have to lead by example. It's your reputation, not their reputation. And if they want to take shortcuts, then go and work somewhere else.
And this is something that you learned at the knee of other British chefs as a young man, as you made your way out of Leeds, propelled by what? It's amazing to think that you had never been to France, you'd never seen a French restaurant, your father had been a chef.
My father was a chef, my grandfather was a chef. And certain things which my father taught me as a boy, I never really forgot. They always stuck with me. It's like my father used to say to me when I went for an interview, never ask them how much you get paid, and never ask how many hours you're going to work, and always go in your Sunday best.
You not only followed that advice, you on occasion worked for free because you were so determined, so propelled, so in love. You wrote, the only place you were comfortable was in a kitchen.
There's no such thing as working for free, because when you work in those great houses, what they're paying you with is their knowledge. It's about an attitude of mind. Mm. I never went to work. It was a way of life for me, and it still is a way of life.
You had this sense of, I mean, you would draw dishes, you know, at night. You would sit and draw how they would look. What was it you wanted or thought you wanted so badly?
What motivated me was my love for Mother Nature, my admiration for the great French restaurants.
And that you'd never been to.
But I read magazines, even though they were in French, or I looked at the pictures. I got certain books from France, and I tried to put myself in those establishments. I tried to understand what they were trying to achieve. I looked at the way they laid their tables. I took my inspiration from the great French restaurants, and I worked in great French restaurants.
In Britain.
I cooked with great chefs. And a lot of those chefs, they've retired now, but in the modern day, if you look at a lot of great restaurants, the chef's not behind the stove. He's in front of a TV camera. He's somewhere else doing whatever he's doing. It's if they've forgotten what made them great, was them being behind the stove. When you cook with great people, something rubs off on you. They bring something out of you. If those great people aren't in the kitchen, then where's the greatness? It's like the day I won my 3 stars in the Michelin Guide. Mr. Brown from the Michelin came to see me, and it was a very emotional time for me. But then I walked him to the door after the meeting, and he shook my hand goodbye, and he said to me, he said, "Marco, never forget what made you great." And you have to respect that.
And and what made you great was?
Just being behind the stove. That's what he was saying. Right. Stay behind your stove, Marco. And you know, I had 3 options when I was 38 years old. Because I wanted to bow out. I'd come to that stage, I'd done my time, I'd done 23 years in a kitchen. And I felt that I had 3 options. And those 3 options were, the first option was to continue working 6 days a week, 16 to 18 hours, kissing my children goodbye in the morning while I sleep, kissing them goodnight when they're in their beds, and retain my status. My second option was to live a lie and to pretend I cook when I don't cook.
To go away from the stove and get someone else to cook.
To continue charging high prices when I'm not there. To question my integrity and everything that I'd worked for all my life. My third option was to pluck up the courage within myself, give back my stars, hang up my apron, and accept that I have no status anymore and I'm unemployed. And that's what I chose to do. And what gave me the strength to make that decision was one day I was fishing. And I caught my salmon. I released my salmon into the river, as I always do. And I always have my ritual cigarette. And I just allow things to drift through my mind. And this morning, when I was fishing, a little thought came into my head. And that was that I'd been judged by people who have less knowledge than me. So if I'm really honest, what's it worth? I'm kidding myself. And so that gave me the courage to walk away. And then I walked away, and for 5 years, 6 years, I spent my time in the woods, in the fields, with my children, fishing.
You eventually began running other places, but not cooking, not the chef. And I'm just wondering, did you also discover that this thing you thought was going to be the pinnacle wasn't maybe what you thought it was?
I was disillusioned. I'd lost all sense of direction. I sat there at the top of my tree. I'd seen people I'd worked for go from 3 stars to 2 stars. I'd seen the knives come in. When I was 1 star, they were my friends. When I was 2 star, I was still their friends. When I became top of the tree and I won my 3 stars and they were no longer at that top of that tree, how people who had been my friends were now putting knives in my back, still being kind to my face.
We heard the story here in the U.S. of the chef who killed himself for fear he wasn't going to get his stars. I mean, your book gives us insight into how powerful this was.
You have to, you know, I've been very fortunate in my life and I've been given great opportunities. And, you know, I'm thankful for all those things. But as I do say, true success is not winning Michelin stars. True success is actually discovery of oneself. Because once you discover yourself as a person, and I took time out to do that, is you can be yourself. And that's when you can start to do things for the right reason and truly realize your true potential.
Former 3-star Michelin chef Marco Pierre White. He speaks about his life in the kitchen in his new memoir, The Devil in the Kitchen, Sex, Pain, Madness, and the Making of a Great Chef. We didn't even get to the several of those, but Marco Pierre White, thank you so much for taking some time with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
By the way, Marco told us that he is going to dust off the apron to make a guest appearance on the British version of Hell's Kitchen, that competition where all the chefs cry. I just say, look out. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.